Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deadliest terrorist attack on Turkish soil, and although blame is yet to be attributed, it does appear to be the work of the Islamic State. But the lack of security provided to the Kurds and the liberals who are the victims of the bombings can be blamed on President Erdogan. Henri Baki, who was formerly a member of the State Department's policy planning staff on the Middle East and in intelligence, and is the author of Turkey's Kurdish Question and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, joins us to look into whether the bombing at a peace rally in the capital, Ankara, will fuel further tensions between the government and the Kurds as the election approaches. Then, as Russia intensifies airstrikes in Syria, we will discuss President Putin's intervention, both in terms of possible blowback from the Sunni Muslim world and whether negotiations between the U.S. and Russia to deal with the danger associated with the U.S. and Russian planes operating in the same airspace could lead to a diplomatic settlement. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, joins us to discuss a dangerous revival of Cold War rhetoric emerging from recent developments in Syria. Then finally, we will speak with an historian of the Congress, Keith Poole, to find out whether the dysfunction in the House is at a record low, with the Tea Party holding the Republicans hostage as they scramble to find a replacement for the outgoing Speaker and his substitute who withdrew his nomination. We'll examine the roots and reasons for political gridlock and paralysis and determine who benefits from it as the rest of the country suffers. And joining us now is Henri Baki, who is the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He serves as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Baki.
Thank you.
And do you think you can fairly blame the obviously not the terrorist attack in Ankara, the capital of Turkey, but certainly, and that appears to be the work of the Islamic State, but the fact that there was so little security afforded the Kurds and the liberals, who are unquestionably the political rivals of President Erdogan, how much does Erdogan bear responsibility for not protecting his own citizens?
Well, I mean, it's not the president directly who's responsible. It should be security and the Minister of Interior who should bear the blame for this, because whenever there is a rally by supporters of the government or the ruling party, they take a lot of precautions, including sometimes outrageously, because, for example, the other day there was a rally by a known mafia leader in favor of the government in his hometown, and there was security there. So this in this particular case, the fact that there was no security is really a big black eye for the government, and especially for the Minister of Interior, who incidentally claims that there was no let up in security. This was not a failure of the security, but this is a little bit like denying that gravity exists. I mean, this is the most horrific bombing in the capital city, the most well-defended city in all of Turkey, given the presence of all the government institutions, all the foreign embassies. There's an amazing police presence and security presence, and they didn't plan for this. And in that sense, this is reprehensible. Also, there are reports that after the bombing, the security forces used tear gas and water cannons on the people who were trying to rescue and trying to pull out the wounded and the dead. And that also, you know, it was a failure of the security services. I mean, at the very least, the Minister of Interior has to resign. I mean, somebody has to resign. This is the third bombing in 6 months, and that has targeted relatively the same people, and there's been no arrest, no blame by the government as to who actually did it. And what the government is trying to do at the moment, especially the prime minister, is try to make political hay out of this. But it does look like it's the Islamic State that did it. I mean, it looks like it would like them. They're not going to claim responsibility for it. because it's not to their benefit to claim responsibility. They have a very vast network in Turkey that supports the brethren in Syria. It's not just the network that brings in foreign jihadists, but there's also money laundering. It's supplying them with their needs. There's also people who really do believe in the Islamic State. So they have a vast network, and were they to say, oh, we did it, the Turkish government would then have to go all out to find them and arrest them. And, of course, why attract attention when you don't have to? I mean, everybody assumes that it's the Islamic State, and they've made that point.
Well, but the fact that the same coalition of Kurds and liberals and secularists were the very block, the voting block, that surprised Erdogan in his power grab and denied him his power grab, and now he's having another election to have a second bite at the apple, to try and grab even more constitutional powers unto himself. How's this going to play in terms of motivating the very opposition that he's, I don't know how much he's trying to suppress them, but he certainly was obviously unhappy about the last results. And I take it that the state media and are pulling out all the stops to get their people elected, and how are they treating the Kurds and the liberals? Are they vilifying them?
Well, they certainly are vilifying them. But look, Turkey at the moment is exceedingly polarized, in the sense that this bombing will only deepen the polarization. I don't think it's going to make much difference in terms of the voting outcome. Maybe some people who did not vote last time will decide to vote for one or the other side. But the more worrisome part in terms of what the government is doing is that it is systematically stifling all voices of dissent. I mean, they arresting journalists. I mean, imagine, there has been all these bombings and they haven't arrested anybody, and somebody went to jail the other day for sending out four tweets that were critical of the president. And for that, they don't seem to spare any effort at reading people's email, tweets, etc., and prosecuting. The other problem is that the state is using its power to limit the reach of the opposition media. For instance, they now will not let television stations to broadcast on a satellite network, and they removed essentially six opposition television networks from the satellite distribution system, which means that people in many parts of the country cannot watch it. Maybe 70% of the Turkish press is probably either controlled or sympathetic or has been created by Erdogan and his party. So you have this continuous barrage of information that they are trying to use essentially to sway the outcome of the election. Whether or not that will be successful, I don't know. I mean, today people have other means of getting information. I mean, even in the mostly remote areas, even if you yourself don't have a cell phone, you know somebody who has a cell phone who will give you information. So I am actually doubtful that the government will be successful. It may change the election results a little bit on the margins, but by and large, I think people are very, very, very determined as to who they're going to vote for. And this polarization, actually, the big problem is the election is not going to solve the problem of polarization in the country. Turkey is headed for essentially a period of acrimony, tension, probably violence, which in the end is not good for Turkey. It's not good for the citizens of Turkey. This is an economy that is quite integrated with the rest of the world. It's a global economy. It's an economy that relies on tourism, on exports. So any decline in the level of confidence in Turkish institution will mean that fewer dollars will go to Turkey in terms of investment or tourism. So all of these things are ultimately will have a negative impact on Turkey. And unfortunately, the president is hell-bent on changing the constitution and winning this next election. In the end, by the way, this is a do-or-die election for Erdogan, the president. Even though technically he's supposed to be above party, technically he's not. He's supposed to be equidistant from all political movements in Turkey. He has made it very clear. He still is. He's supporting his own party, from which he came, the AKP. He wants them to win. He's pulling all the stops to make sure that they win, and he's breaking the constitution. I mean, the constitution says you're not supposed to do these things, and nobody seems to be able to say, look, you can't do this. This is illegal. He has achieved an enormous amount of informal power over the country in a way in which no other leader since Atatürk, I would say, ever managed. So Turkey is moving towards a far more authoritarian system. I mean, as I said earlier, if you tweet and they don't like your tweets, they prosecute you and send you to jail. Look, there are journalists who are in prison now, people for whom they have not yet offered an indictment, and yet they've been in jail for 300 plus days. I mean, how can you be in jail without being accused of anything? And the judicial system is now cowed by the president. Nobody can seem to be able to do anything. So, but if he loses these elections, and this is the point I was trying to make, it will be a major embarrassment and it will be a major blow at Erdogan, for the simple reason that two elections, two defeats where he was the main issue, where people were voting for or against him. If he loses two in a row, I think he will lose a great deal of his that informal power. You will see that there will be other forces emerge in the country, or even in his own party, to challenge him. So I suspect that this is going to be a very tense election, and at the same time, for Erdogan, it's really do or die.
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Barker, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and is authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. So Erdogan, of course, takes things very personally. He has a massive ego. He built this massive palace for himself, hundreds of millions of dollars. He was apparently quite friendly with the Assads in Syria, and then when they turned on their own people, he got very angry and has prosecuted as much as he can the war against them through surrogates, as the U.S. to some extent is. But of course, it's complicated by the Kurdish question on his southern border. Is the same thing likely to happen with Turkey's relationship with Russia? How personal was the Erdogan Putin relationship, and I believe that Erdogan is very angry at Putin.
Well, there's a difference between Assad and Putin. With Assad, Erdogan saw himself as kind of the mentor. He took Assad under his wing. He had Assad and the Assad's government and the Turkish government had joint meetings, cabinet meetings. They established a very, very, very close relationship. So when the Arab Spring started in Syria, Erdogan actually very wisely, counseled Assad to do the right thing. And I think that, Erdogan deserves credit. I mean, he went out of his way and he sent his advisor, then Davutoğlu, to Syria to convince Assad to essentially adopt a different posture towards the rebellion that was emerging, or the Arab Spring, but Assad would not listen to him. And that's where he turned. And Assad, the more violence Assad used, the more Erdogan was horrified. And in that sense, you have to give credit to Erdogan in that he tried to do the right thing at the beginning. But the relationship with Putin is not the same as the relationship with Assad. Putin and Erdogan do not have this mentor-mentee relationship. Erdogan sees himself as an equal, if anything. But Erdogan and Putin have been very, very careful to not allow their relationship become acrimonious as a result of Syria. If you look at the rhetoric that comes out of Ankara towards Russia, it's always quite mild. It's always a little bit regretful. Erdogan the other day said, you know, he's a good friend of Putin. Putin should think twice about losing him as a friend. I mean, when you look at the language, it's very, very different. And partially because the two men have established a relationship, partially because Turkey and Russia need each other, especially in terms of oil, gas exports. Russia is, after all, the bear in the north. It's a huge country with which Turkey has had difficult relations historically. So there is it's a different relationship. And I would hasten to say that when you look at Erdogan's rhetoric towards President Obama, who is a formal ally of Turkey, who Turkey and the United States are, you know, two very important members of the NATO alliance, yet Erdogan, in his criticisms of President Obama, doesn't mince any words. He attacks him, he insults him, and yet Obama is his ally, and Putin is on Syria, does exactly the opposite. So what I'm trying to say is that Erdogan and Putin have been quite careful, and yes, this escalation is very problematic for Turkey because it does mean that the Assad regime is going to survive maybe this for the next few years, and that is a major source of consternation and setback for Erdogan. And clearly, you're seeing a change in the pro-Erdogan newspaper's attitude towards Russia. But I would say that people should be careful not to expect a major break between Turkey and Russia, between Erdogan and Putin. They will agree to disagree, and they may disagree a little bit more vehemently than in the past, but I don't think it would be kind of an all-out verbal war. It's not going to be a hot war, obviously. And the fact that the Russian aircraft have crossed the Turkish airspace a few times is Putin is doing it essentially to stick it to Obama, but in a way he's also using Turkey to do it, and that's actually a source of consternation for Erdogan because it makes Erdogan look bad in the process. But I suspect that they will figure out a way to work these things out. But it is true that the Turkish-Russian relationship is worse today than it was even a year ago, and it remains to be seen what Putin will do and what the Russians will do in Syria in the future. I mean, we don't still know what the Russian battle plan is for Syria. Is it just to solidify what Assad has at the moment and make sure that he doesn't lose any more territory, or is it designed to capture more territory, especially north of Aleppo towards the Turkish border, etc.? Is that what he has in mind? We don't know those things yet. And I think what Putin does in the future will determine Erdogan's posture. But how is Turkey going to replace the gas it gets from Russia? It can't, right? It's not just that. It's a huge number of Turkish companies are operating in Russia, building in the construction sector. Russia is a very important trading partner. It's not something you can ditch overnight and impose sanctions, etc.
Well, Henri Barkey, I thank you very much for joining us here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And joining us now is Nina Kresheva, who's a professor in the Graduate School of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She is also an editor and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kresheva.
Thank you.
And I know that that you're concerned, and as I am, about a revival of Cold War rhetoric vis-a-vis or since Putin's intervention in Syria. But it surely it can't be a surprise. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, there's been reports that Putin blindsided Obama, et cetera. I mean, I spoke with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer about a month ago in Moscow, and he laid it out exactly what was going to happen. So it certainly wasn't a surprise to listeners of this program, and anybody that follows what Putin has been saying should have seen it coming. So do you buy that idea that we are blindsided? And if so, then we don't look particularly good, do we?
I don't think the United States looks particularly good in this scenario, because if they were blindsided, then it's very unclear who is responsible for the Russian policy in the State Department and elsewhere around President Obama, because the movements in Syria started at least in August or late July. Bashar al-Assad, Syria's president, was very weakened at the time, and there was a great concern in Moscow that Bashar al-Assad could be unseated, and if he's unseated, then Syria will turn into a mess very similar to what happened in Libya when Colonel Gaddafi was out. So Russians have been really planning some sort of involvement in Syria one way or another, and in fact started pulling the troops in late in August in support of the naval base that they had in Tartus in Syria. So it is, I think, when Americans saying that they're blindsided, it's more a reference to the fact that we as in Americans keep saying to Putin, don't do this and don't do that, and he does it anyway. And I think that kind of enrages the State Department and foreign policy officials and generally the American pundits the most, is that Putin just doesn't cooperate.
So do you think there's an element, though, in this of Putin having been ostracized by the White House and been little to no contact with Obama, that he's sort of saying, okay, you want to freeze me out? Well, I'm going to make myself indispensable, and you can't ignore me.
Absolutely, and I've been talking about it in this program for years now, is that Putin may not necessarily contribute to many positive outcomes, but he's certainly a splinter, and that's his greatest talent. He's a master of using other people's weaknesses to his own advantage. And he has shown that he's really very good at that. And it just the White House or general American punditry seems to be ignoring that fact and been ignoring it for a long, long time, is that Putin did say, "You will not, I'm not a regional power." In some ways, it was a echo of what Barack Obama said about him after Crimea was annexed in the spring of 2014. Barack Obama said, you know, he's nothing, Putin is nothing but, Russia is nothing but a regional power. And Putin has been showing that, regional or not, he's certainly very, very important and his views need to be considered. He should be taken. His position should be taken into account. So in some ways, it's also kind of sticking it to the West on a even on a higher level than Putin has been going at since the beginning of his presidency in 2000.
So how much, though, is there a vestige of the KGB mindset in Putin of the principal adversary or the main enemy, as the KGB always referred to the United States?
Well, KGB is important. I mean, there is a mindset. It is a somewhat secretive mindset. What I find really very interesting about Putin and rather unusual, he's both consistent and clandestine at the same time. And I think that is very difficult probably for the Protestant mind people to understand, is that on one hand he is very deceiving, on the other hand he says exactly what he's going to do. And if one is to follow Putin's actions very closely, none of it should come as a surprise, and it continuously coming as a surprise because he's a darer, he's a political gambler, obviously, and I think his gambles are rather big, and it seems to me that people are unwilling to accept that he's going to go that large. I mean, he would surely be more cautious, and he's not a cautious kind of guy. And so I think there's it's almost ridiculous to say it after 25 years of relationship, open relationship between Russia and the United States, but it seems to me that there is a tremendous culture clash that is still playing itself out, although the borders have been open for so long.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. So the extent to which Putin is the new czar, and he has accrued enormous power, clearly, the Duma seems to be a complete rubber stamp, and Medvedev and the others, I'm not sure what their roles are. What's your sense of are the institutions still operating in Russia, or are they completely under control? Because my sense is that if you have a czar with all of those enormous powers, it gets to the point where he has too much power to function. If he has to make decisions about everything and he can't delegate, that seems to be also a recipe for dysfunction. Not that we don't have a lot of dysfunction here in our government.
But, you know, Russia is not a well-oiled machine. I mean, there's also, I think, in some ways, if we think that way, that would be a mistake, because it is a very bureaucratic, very sort of top-to-bottom operated political institution. And when we say Putin is a new czar, once again, we're way behind the times, because he has been that, well, probably if not in 2000 when he was first elected president, but as of 2004 when he was second elected president. And you mentioned Dmitry Medvedev, who is the current prime minister, was a kind of keeping Putin's presidential seat from 2008 to 2012, while Putin, they basically switched roles, and Putin became prime minister while Medvedev was president. But, you know, Putin has been running the country for 15 years. So the new czar, he's not that new, in fact, anymore. I mean, he's been around for so long. It is dysfunctional, but it does function in a very interesting way. It's a total agenda, and the total agenda is that Russia is great. Russia needs to do anything it needs to do to insert its very important position in the world. It looks at everybody else as if it's an enemy, and I think one of the things that Putin did very cleverly is that, for example, Russians wouldn't take the war rations. Well, I mean, there's no war rations, but, you know, when sanctions came in over Crimea, they were still they came in incremental pieces, and therefore it wasn't too big shock, too much of a shock of a system. The Russians wanted to be a great power, but Crimea was fought, or East Ukraine was fought far away from them. Syria is even further. But I think ideologically what Putin did very cleverly is that now Russia is in the path of war, regardless of how close or far away the war is. And so if Russians are requested to give up a lot of comforts, they now can, but it came slowly. So the fact that the system is dysfunctional is not so as important as the fact that, as a nation, Russia is willing to sacrifice a lot of things in order to keep Russia great and have Putin as the new Tsar or as the Tsar to rule them, because the perception now is that if it's not Putin, it's going to be much worse. I don't believe that this can last for a long time, but it can last for some time, and Putin is very much interested for it to last until at least 2024, when technically he will be out of all constitutional possibilities for him to stay in the Kremlin.
And he'd be 72 years old.
Exactly, comparing to others, and, yeah. And it would be very interesting. It would be very interesting. I mean, it's horrible, but it's going to be a very interesting phenomenon, because he would split the difference between Stalin, Joseph Stalin, who was in power for almost 30 years, and Leonid Brezhnev, who was in power for almost 20 years.
So, turning to the possible downside of what's happening, there's a possible upside, in a sense, that the U.S. and Russia are in negotiations about making sure that their aircraft don't run into each other, since they're both. I don't know whether you saw the Charlie Rose interview with Ben Carson, who's the number two Republican now in the presidential race. He was asked by Charlie Rose, would you recommend a no-fly zone? And he said, of course, because Putin's in there. He's out to get all the Middle East oil, and we got to stop him. And then Charlie Rose said, well, if the Russians had a no-fly zone, what would you do? And he said, "And would you violate it?" And he said, yeah. And Charlie Rose said, well, what then? And he said, well, there'd be a battle royale. I mean, this is a guy running for president, for God's sake.
He also, I mean, we Ben Carson, I know we like him because he's a doctor, and in America we like doctors quite a bit, but his knowledge of history and foreign affairs, I would not really rely on. I mean, we just heard from him that apparently Holocaust wouldn't have happened if Jews had guns.
Right.
Right.
Well, I agree. This is a conversation.
I know.
The conversation for another day. But there's no question that we're perhaps in a new know nothing era here in the United States, and perhaps he won't get elected, or Trump won't get elected, whatever. We can only hope. But the fact that the planes, Russian planes and American planes, are in the same airspace is a recipe for disaster, and apparently both sides are working on means to avoid such a disaster. Could those kind of talks lead to some diplomatic settlement?
Those kind of talks should lead to some sort of better understanding. I mean, I mentioned cultural clash, and I really hope that that. And that's what, in some ways, Putin cleverly forced the United States to do, is that you have to deal with me on the terms that I'm giving you. Don't lecture me. Don't tell me what to do. But we do have common interests. But and I'm willing to talk, I'm willing to understand, and we all understand how difficult world affairs are. But really, it has to be on equal terms. And I think that he did force the United States into the corner and made them negotiate with him. For example, Barack Obama is now talking about the political solution in Syria, something that Putin have been talking about for 3 years, three, 4 years. So Putin did bring everybody to the negotiating table by using force, and it is an important feature of his, and something that really needs to be considered when he's dealt with. It is absolutely, it is a recipe for disaster, because if at best it is turning into a proxy war of the old Soviet kind, which, as we know, really didn't bring any positive results to any country. So just as that, it is a problem. But, if any presidential candidate actually has a reasonable, not a solution, because we're far from any solution, but at least a reasonable suggestion, it's Hillary Clinton, who talks about the negotiated no-fly zones and cooperation on all levels. And, I would suggest that Barack Obama, hopefully next conversation with Putin will take less than a year. I mean, they did talk. I mean, when we say they didn't talk for a long time, we slightly exaggerate that, because they've been talking on the phone, but sort of formal conversation, they just saw each other at the United Nations here in New York. And I do hope that at this point, their conversations will take many, many more, much more frequent schedule, and as many more parties to this kind of relationship will get involved. But Putin made it very clear: don't lecture me, and consider me as your equal. And in this sense, he certainly achieved his goal.
Well, we'll stay tuned here, and I hope I don't have to call you back. And when the Islamic State is holding a Russian pilot hostage, or a GRU fighter that they've captured and are about to behead
that
him.
That will happen.
Yeah.
That will happen.
I was going to say, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but there is a downside, clearly. And we'll follow up on that, I hope, at some point soon. Thank you so much, Nina.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Nina Kresheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And her latest book is The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind.
I have breathed all the sea. Your orphan prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology and Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. And his latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crisis and the Failure of American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Poole.
Yes, glad to be here.
And Keith, do you think, since you're an historian of the Congress, has it ever been this bad? It seems so dysfunctional and so broken, and the Republicans are having a hard time even choosing a speaker. The one that they all want doesn't want the job, and whoever they probably end up getting, they're going to have to rely on Democratic votes. It just feels like a complete meltdown.
Well, they had similar meltdowns in the 19th century, and there have been prolonged speaker battles that occurred in the 19th century that took months. But there hasn't been a situation like this in decades now, and that's basically the problem is that you've got sort of, if you want to think about it this way, three parties in Congress. You've got the Democrats, the conservative, kind of standard conservative Republicans that we're used to over the years, and then this Freedom Caucus that basically they want to essentially stop everything from moving. And because they've got about 40, the caucus doesn't release its membership rolls, but they have something between 40 and 45 members. And even though the Republicans have the largest group since the 1928 election, namely 247 members, you take away 40 to 45 members, and you don't have 218. So it's a real mess. And even if Paul Ryan managed to put together 218, even if someone did put together the 218, they'd have to make concessions to the Freedom Caucus to do so, and that would mean almost certainly a government shutdown and confrontation over a set of issues that they're very intense about, including not closing Guantanamo Bay, which actually has a lot of Democrats on their side on that one. So, yeah, we're headed into a really big mess, to which I don't really see a good resolution. And since we're talking to me from Southern California, part of this, and it's an absolute crisis, is the Transportation Act, which has this provision to delay positive train control for a couple of years, which is absolutely essential because the freight railroads just simply haven't been able to implement this radio-controlled safety system over a huge network, and if this does not pass, what it means is that all the commuter rail systems in the United States, all of them that use freight railroad tracks, will have to stop operation in 21 days. And the railroads may actually stop because their legal status will be unclear. And what that means, just to give people an idea, is that all water systems and a lot of other institutions use chlorine. And as disagreeable as this sounds, the only way you can move chlorine is by railroad tank car. It's extremely dangerous stuff, but it's the only way it can be moved, and it's essential. So if the railroads actually shut, the economy of the United States will come to a grinding halt within 10 days. That's the stakes That are the stakes here. The government shutdown is actually peanuts compared to some of these other things that may happen.
And again, I'm speaking with Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston, Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia. And he's a Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. And his latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of an American Democracy. So in terms of, though, of the 40, between 40 and 50 of the so-called Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party, have we had that again in the historical context, a group of people in the government, in the Congress, who don't believe in government itself? And if anything, they want to undermine, if not wreck, government itself.
No, that would be... The only thing close to that would be the crises that led up to the Civil War, and that's quite different. This is basically a counter-revolution to the New Deal, and they basically want to see Planned Parenthood defunded and they don't want the debt ceiling raised any further, and they're quite willing just to simply let the government come to a grinding stop. And they're frustrated with President Obama's unilateral actions on a number of things. So my guess is that at some point you will see the conservative Republicans probably come up with some kind of temporary caretaker that will just simply have an informal agreement with Leader Pelosi that there's a certain number of things we've got to put on the floor and pass. And so I think the end game here is and I think that's what Boehner was trying to do, is save the party from itself by basically suspending the debt ceiling until after the presidential election. That would take that off the table until 2017. And the other way they could, the other action they could take would be just doing a continuing resolution through probably, say, November, through November of 2016, and put that after the presidential election. That actually would save the Republican Party in the presidential election. But the Freedom Caucus is something like George Armstrong Custer charging the Sioux with, you know, breech-loading rifles. It's crazy. It's not going to work. At some point, you're going to have this coalition of Democrats and Republicans, because a lot of the conservative Republicans want the government to function, even though they don't agree with some of the things that are going on.
Well, it is a bit mystifying, Keith Poole, to try and get your head around it, and I'm wondering how much this has to do simply with the quality of people that are coming into Congress. I did an interview recently with a political scientist at the University of Massachusetts, Tom Ferguson, who'd done research into who funded the Tea Party in the first place. And a lot of the money came from Wall Street. So you wonder whether they would, at this point, having buyer's remorse. But I don't know whether you saw any of the clips of Kevin McCarthy, who had to step down. His speeches and his press conferences are completely incoherent. I mean, he makes Sarah Palin seem breathtakingly articulate. You know, I just am shocked at the quality of some of the people involved here. Obviously, Kevin McCarthy could not have survived.
The bad news is that this isn't just limited to the Republicans.
Sure.
And the other bad news is that essentially the rich, I mean, I'm talking about the mega rich, and Wall Street fund both political parties. It's no accident, for example, that the hedge fund boys get away with murder with this carried interest deduction that Chuck Schumer protects. We found in Political Bubbles, and there's a paper we have in the Journal of Economic Perspectives that shows us that essentially the rich are fairly evenly divided between the two parties, and the Wall Street money is, there's just so much money there that the 0.1% of donors accounted for more than 40-some% of all the campaign expenditures in the 2012 elections. So this is the political parties are by the rich, for the rich, and it's no accident that, when Obama held all the cards at the fiscal cliff, when all the tax cuts would have expired, he could have let them expire and then only put back in certain things. But Joe Biden made that deal with McConnell, and the top rate only went up to 39, about 40%. And that's one of the reasons why Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are attracting such large crowds. Even though they're very, very different, the truth of the matter is that almost all the economic gain since the end of the Great Recession has gone to the top 1% or 0.5%. And inequality has been skyrocketing now for the last 20 years. And the middle class and the working classes have been screwed. And they know it. And they're frustrated. They don't know what to do about it. And, both political parties are, to some extent, dysfunctional. The Democrats basically are split because the old-style blue-collar unions are weak now. But it used to be that the Congress would vote vast sums of money to lay rebar and pour concrete, which employed vast numbers of men. And now you have this widespread, basically, malaise because we're not doing that anymore. We can't do anything.
Exactly.
Congress is paralyzed.
Right.
The Republicans don't want to spend any money. The Greens use the legal system to stop almost all public projects. And there's a reason why people are ticked off.
Right.
It's a system that's just about ready to melt down, in my view. And I think we're beginning to see the first parts of it.
Well, but Keith Poole, adding to your list there of the dysfunction and the lack of logic and excuses for what's going on, when you talk about rebar and concrete and putting people to work, we have the lowest interest rates almost in history. So money is so incredibly cheap.
And you know who that benefits? When you have almost when the overnight rate at the Fed is near zero, what that means is the giant banks could basically borrow overnight and leverage that money to make more money. Right. That's why these banks have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're absolutely stuffed with cash. And that's also why the stock market, kind of went up for a long time there. But it doesn't help. It doesn't help the middle classes at all.
Well, I was going to say that.
And, it's outrageous, and it's interesting that even though Donald Trump, I think, I don't think he's stupid, but I think he's basically more of a performance artist. If you listen to what his tax proposals are, and his fan base doesn't appear to hear it. He really wants to tax the rich, and so does Bernie Sanders. And we need to jack the tax rates up, especially on the higher incomes, because they made off with all the money. And, you know, we're not spending money on building things and so on. It's just really an outrage.
Well, just in the last minute, though, isn't there a difference, though? I mean, it's true, Chuck Schumer is in the pocket of Wall Street and he's protected carried interest. But, you know, he might be the leader of the Senate if, you know, Harry Reid's stepping down. And
If the Republicans nominate a crazy, Hillary Clinton would win in a landslide. But Hillary Clinton's in real deep trouble right now, because it's not the Republicans and this Benghazi nonsense. That's what's got her in trouble, is the Freedom of Information Act and the federal judge forcing out all this stuff. And she's clearly guilty of the same thing that BS charge they got General Petraeus on. But the Democrats are likely to win the presidential election, and if the Republicans run some guy like Trump, you'll see a landslide, and the Democrats will take back the Senate, and Chuck Schumer will be in the majority leader, yes.
Right. I was going to say, though, that at least, you know, he's more intelligent and articulate than Kevin McCarthy. I'm just I wasn't talking about how corrupt they are and in whose pockets they are, but just whether they can function in an intelligent and coherent way. The bar is so low. I guess that's the point I wanted to make. But
well, Paul Ryan becomes Speaker. He's a really smart guy, too.
Right.
And
he doesn't want the job.
you would see, actually, Boehner is not a dummy.
Right.
Boehner actually did, history will treat Boehner a lot better than the people are right now, because he was basically dealt a really bad hand, and he played poker with a really bad hand. And he did pretty well until these guys just basically, you know,
right,
forced him out.
Well,
they're going to live to regret it, too.
Keith Poole, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
You bet. Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Olson Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. His latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.